Geshe. May the sacred presence of him who said who abided his teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and tread with unfaltering steps this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment.
All Buddhas throughout space and time, all hundred months, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha, prajna, paramita.
Welcome to class number 3 of precepts. Is anybody here who has not been to one of the preceding classes from this series? Okay, great. We will go around. Anybody else? Let's go ahead around and do names, just for repetition, for my benefit. I am Anand.
Donna.
How about you?
Renzo.
Nisha.
Alicia.
Sonia.
Genko.
Mark.
John.
Keisha.
Chico.
John. Andy.
Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel.
Didier.
David.
Carl.
Madeline.
Kagan.
Ian.
Hannah.
Carl.
Karen.
Brian.
Phyllis.
Will.
Will.
Did anyone not get the handout last week? The new guy. Anybody else? Okay, so tonight it gets a little less abstract and a little more concrete.
We did this
evening. We are moving into the grave precepts tonight, and so we are looking at the first three of those: do not kill, do not steal, do not misuse sexuality. And so up until this point, we've kind of been setting the stage with contrition and with the three refuges and the three aspects, past, present, and future, present, and how they come to us, and relative and absolute aspects of those refuges. So we've owned up to our karma. We have taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And last time we just started talking a little bit about the three pure precepts. So cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others, which we'll start up with those this evening to start with. And then we'll jump into the great precepts, the first three. So are there any questions or comments or things to report from last time? If anybody wants to bring it? Yeah, Brian?
Kind of the answer to this because I asked Chico. But do only good takes up this action. The Dharma of the Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, I didn't know what that was, and then it rose. It's probably described in the next couple of words. But I was wondering why that's not translated.
Uh-huh. Why it's not translated. Chico, do you know what's the truth here?
It's just the way we say it. Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. It means complete perfect enlightenment.
Yes.
Right off the top.
It really does. There's a little bit about that in the precept study book, if you have one of those.
Yeah.
And Kyogen's observation on that is basically it's bringing the idea that complete perfect enlightenment is now. And so I don't know if that's why it's not translated, but that's the idea, is that our complete perfect enlightenment is the same as the Buddha's complete perfect enlightenment. It is in this moment right now. So maybe it's a point of emphasis. Mm-hmm. It wasn't translated to make you pay attention, possibly. I'm not sure.
I think it's just the assumption that we all are supposed to know that for
it. Right.
Sure, you know.
Anything else? Other questions or observations before we jump in? Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
If do good for others, there's this phrase, leap beyond the holy and the unholy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what it means by that. If examples are, if like holy is fulfilling a precept, or it's a totally different thing.
That is a great question. It's almost like I planted you there. Remind me of your name.
Will.
Will. It's almost like I planted you right there.
Will the shill.
all of you. So this is the third one. Do good for others. Embrace all things and conditions. Leap beyond the holy and the unholy. Let us rescue ourselves together with all beings. And I'm really curious what you all make of that, because it's strange phrasing to talk about holiness, right? We don't usually talk about holiness here around the Zen Center. And then rescuing ourselves together with all beings. We've talked a little bit about that bodhisattva ideal. But what does that have to do with this doing good for others, embracing all things and conditions? I'm curious about your thoughts on that. Any reactions to holy versus unholy? Yes.
Sometimes I feel like we can get trapped in an idea of being holy or being a certain way, and that can actually hinder us from really just dropping into that ground being and kind of enacting from that space.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I perceive that.
Okay, that's great. So don't worry about the holiness or unholiness, just act sort of in a way that's unencumbered or not overthinking
it.
The word that strikes me is the word leap. Like, I'm really curious about why it's leap. I like it, because it has a springiness and aliveness to it.
Yeah.
And kind of a, maybe even just sort of forgetting those distinctions between holy and holy.
Right.
But I'm dying to know what the word might have been, or how else it might have been translated.
Right.
Step, move, you know. Leap's pretty dramatic.
It is very dramatic, depending on what you're leaping into or out of.
Out of fire.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, to comment on that specific piece of this, to me the leaping is, to emphasize that this is an activity. Mm. This is, you know, a lot of what we do in Zazen, at least from the outside, can appear passive. And this sort of precept is a complement or a reflection of that practice. Mm. This is the time to bring into action. Which, of course, doesn't always mean taking action, right? Because you're taking concrete, like I can measure your action. Sometimes that might be a refraining, but this idea that there's an active exertion of sort of will or intention or decision to act or refrain from acting. Yeah, Mike?
I heard a Zen phrase that just came to mind listening to what's been said. Before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know really why, but I guess just keep coming forward, keep stepping forward,
right.
Regardless of holy or unholy,
right.
Keep showing up.
Keep showing up, yeah. Chico, did you have a comment?
Well, you know, it doesn't say do good for some others. It says do good for others. And in fact, we divide people up and beings up all the time into good and bad, worthy and unworthy. I'll help this one, but not that one. That's what we do. And this is saying, drop that and just do good for other beings, whatever your opinion of it may be. I would point out that Dogen loves the verb leap.
Uh-huh.
He uses to leap a lot. His death poem says, alive, I leap into the Yellow Springs, which is the land of the dead. So I'm not surprised to see that word there. Also, it's kind of a big thing to jump over, right? The holy and the unholy is a big obstacle. So we probably need a running jump just to get over the dang thing.
I'm just going to step over that.
Well, yeah, I thought it was just very appropriate because, like, holiness is a trap.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a lot of work being holy and got to maintain images. It's a lot of work.
Right. Yeah, so another point to drop yourself. Lay off with that business. Good. Other thoughts on holy and unholy and rescuing ourselves together with all beings?
There's something just really kind of sweet about that to me, or there's something about the precepts that can feel sort of, oh, it's like another thing I should work on and get better at and do, and there's just something about this line that's like really it's so all-encompassing.
Yeah. Complete.
And it's like the work of a moment, like Autumn was saying. It's not something you just hack away at all your life. There's this moment when you just leap completely into oneness and natural goodness.
And I love this reference to let us rescue ourselves together with all beings, because you know, sort of a truism that we start practice to relieve our own suffering, then our practice expands to include the suffering of other beings. and then it's the practice itself. But this idea that if we follow the precepts, maybe we start down this path because we want to reduce our own suffering, but ultimately following the precepts is good for everybody. I mean, think of the world if everyone adhered to the precepts wholeheartedly. What a different... We are saving all beings, you know. One more person following the precepts is sort of contributing to this greater good in a way that when you initially encounter these, you might not have in mind, but is definitely sort of a factor as you move forward acting according to these principles. So I love that reminder in here. One other thing I wanted to point out that I didn't mention before... At the very beginning of this, so right before the contrition verse, for they in the past were as we are now, and we will be as they in the future. This is a very deep idea in our line of Zen, this prediction of universal Buddhahood. This is in the Lotus Sutra as well, you'll see this, and this is also here. I just wanted to point it out for those of you who are looking for such things or are interested in such things. There is a universal prediction of Buddhahood based on our inherent Buddha nature that we all have, the future as a Buddha. And so that emphasis here in the precepts, I think, is interesting to note. That prediction is here too, not just in the Lotus Sutra. And one other thing that came, I subscribe to this daily sort of Zen quote thing that and sometimes they're really good at, sometimes they're just less good. But the one that came in today was really interesting in light of our class. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. When we say, I take refuge in the Buddha, we should also understand that the Buddha takes refuge in me. Because without the second part, the first part is not complete. The Buddha needs us for awakening, understanding, and love to be real things and not just concepts. They must be real things that have real effects on life. So that's kind of a perfect complement to some of what we talked about last time. Okay, so the three pure precepts, there is a little bit in the study book about that I wanted to point out. I think I have a different numbering in here. Cease from evil, do only good, do good for others. For those of you who have your study books handy, I'm going to be looking at page 11. If you don't worry about it, I can read this out to you. You can take a look later if you want to go back to it. But this business about do good for others, this is the second half of page 11 that I just wanted to call out. Because it can be a little confusing. So, okay, cease from evil, that seems pretty straightforward. Drop the self. Do only good. Okay. Once you've dropped your conditioned self, then you can step forward in sort of clean way to take action. And then do only good for others can seem a little redundant. Why are we adding this extra one when you've dropped the self and you're already stepping forward to act? So I just wanted to call out a little bit of what Kyogen has to say about that. Do good for others. Embrace all things and conditions. Lead beyond the holy and unholy. Let us rescue ourselves together with all living beings. So that's the quote. And this is Kyogen talking now. There is a progression from cessation, where we step out of our habit energies and impulses, to learning to move unbound by them in some freedom. But always there will be some things that are dangerous to get into that could pull us into habit energy again. What this section is saying is that we should not become too attached to our own equanimity, which I feel like is a very helpful reminder.
That's great.
There's a point at which you should be able to move back into the messiness of life. Now, we want to be careful and not bite off more than we can chew. But we don't turn our backs on the world. Instead, we let it affect us, embracing it in our practice. That is doing good for others. And so I felt like that was a helpful clarification, that you drop your karmic conditioning, you step forward to act, but you don't try to hold on to that sort of clean state of non-reactivity. You understand that the world's going to come in, things are going to trigger you again, that this is going to be a process that's ongoing. And the point is not to hold on to this sort of clean place of unconditioned karma, but to sort of wade out into the world and work with it in a way that's contextual and alive in the world. So I just wanted to point out that clarification. You know, back at the ranch, week one, we talked about some of the instructional objectives in this class. One of them is explaining how at least one precept applies to a real life experience, from preferably your own life. But that can be a little awkward in a group, bringing in moral conundrums or ethical conundrums or things that you may or may not be proud of. How does the precept apply to that in front of 40 people? So what I have done as a service to the group is I have come up with a quasi-realistic conundrum. And I have put the three precepts that we're working with tonight at the top of this for your reference. And what I would like for you to do is practice applying the precepts to this quasi-real situation that I have engineered for you. And so at the bottom of the handout, there are five questions about the scenario and how the precepts apply to them. I would like you to pick any three of those five questions to consider as it pertains to your quasi-scenario. And I would like, if we can work in groups of like three or four, just sort of self-clustering. I'm going to wander around so I can eavesdrop on you all. But if you just want to cluster up with a few people nearby and pick your, again, three out of the five questions, there's a lot there to work with. So just pick a few of those, any three.
With ourself and our needs and our wants. Like, this is an original condition of this person being born in a relationship, killing a sense of connection with our own wants and needs. So this person, Jesse, is kind of already cut themselves off from themselves.
Somewhat related that the exhortation with Jesse awakened you by cutting that off instead of killing yourself again.
Flip side.
I was thinking something similar. Like, if Jesse didn't know she was in a relationship, then she killed a potential relationship for him.
Right.
He'd not be able to do anything.
Yeah. But feel free to be fluid with the gender pronouns or potentially.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So trust was killed, maybe a sense of authentic self, maybe a sense of awakened self was killed. Anything else?
Integrity. I promise you're kind of killing your integrity. Okay.
I considered feeling a little bored as like an act of contempt, which I find to be hostile.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. An act of contempt. Can you say
more about that? Yeah, if I'm not wholeheartedly engaging in my intimate relationship, I've already killed their interests and my own. Polarity and like staying engaged, distance and so.
We came back at the end, and that was the point. That was the turning point. Stealing by not revealing the state of boredom.
So
withholding your state of boredom with your partner is an act of stealing, which is aggressive and a way of killing as well. And that was maybe the turning point.
I think your use of the word contempt is really interesting, because there have been some studies about that contempt is actually like the number one predictor of divorce and failed relationships, for whatever the given value of failed is.
And so then moving forward, did you, any of you discuss what it would mean then to cultivate and encourage life? Because there's the do not, so don't kill. But then there's the positive injunction also to then cultivate and encourage life. Were there any thoughts or discussion about that?
At the O.
Yeah, Mark.
Well, I'm just sort of taking from not a analogous or same situation for my own life, but like a similar instance of I felt that I broke trust in a relationship, and for me it was I could see Jesse sort of losing trust, not only in the relationships, but losing trust with the relationship with themselves, mm-hmm. Because of what they've done, because I've done that. And I think that's a very harmful thing that could happen. And if you're going to try and build trust back up in a relationship that you think you've broken, mm-hmm. it's very important to not lose trust in yourself, or if you have, regain trust within yourself and your own actions and well-being and all that stuff. Like, have a foundation before you can actually start building mutual trust in a relationship that has been damaged by something that you've done.
Okay. Keisha, hang on just a second. Other thoughts on this? Cultivating and encouraging life, what would that mean? What's just gone on? What's transpired at the wine bar? Keisha, you're
gonna
say.
So cultivating encouraging life. What's her name?
Yeah. Well, the protagonist is unnamed.
You.
So for the other person is Jesse.
Okay, so I'm feeling like I need to go to a yoga place to make myself more attractive. Like, do I need? What came up in our discussion was so it's not just about the relationship with the other person. Again, going back to the self, this person looking in the mirror and finding themselves attractive. It's not some. I mean, like, yes, there is this really gorgeous, you know, for me, it's a hunky sailor who is like flirting with me and like, wow, he's so attractive and he's finding something attractive in me. Uh-huh. Well, before we even get, let's put. What's his name aside?
The sailor aside.
Let's put the sailor aside.
You're taking too long.
And, like, there's like some body shaming, like looking in the mirror, finding ourselves sexy. Like, this is a body and we're embodied. We're sharing that body with somebody else. Like, looking in the mirror, and it's not just, oh, if I get rid of this little tummy here, then I'll finally be sexy, or taking it for granted. There's a loss of intimacy with this body.
Okay.
So you're saying you were looking for validation in the OBC though?
Well, I don't have validation.
Well,
I mean, I don't. And it's not just that, it's the mirror telling me that I also look pretty. But, yeah.
Okay. I think. I'm going to skip to C because I really want to hear what you have to say. So you didn't actually get it on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember your name, I'm sorry.
Ember.
Ember.
Yeah. So it's do not misuse sexuality, not misuse sex. And so
true.
She or he got involved in asexual situation, flirtatious text, kissing.
Uh-huh.
Personal stories, that kind of thing. And so the fact that they didn't have sex isn't really what we're talking about,
okay.
In my opinion.
No, that's a good point, that the precept is about sexuality and not about the act of sex necessarily or exclusively.
Mm-hmm. And also remaining faithful in relationships is an important aspect of that, obviously.
Yes, that's a positive.
And that was what I thought of with what you were talking about, Will, about them being bored. I felt like that already, if you are bored in your relationship and you're not addressing it, you're already not faithful in your relationship. Because it's not just talking about sexual fidelity, it's talking about when I think about what it means to be faithful in a relationship, it means I attend to that relationship and I have respect for christening in that relationship with it. Just kind of attending to it.
Okay. That means potentially a big part of it. Misuse sexuality by not being sexually active, I suppose. Sorry, I just put it in there, but I thought of it and then there it came up. So I've never thought of it that way. So.
Yeah. But to your point, the precept was broken back and forth. That's when the
sexuality. Yeah, right. I mean, not just getting bored away, but to address it. Yeah.
I mean, not creating a veneer of attachment if the relationship is hollow. No,
keeping it.
Okay.
Well, it wasn't hollow. It was satisfying, solid.
Well, but now. Yeah.
So
solid
robot.
Yeah.
That was what was not cultivated.
Okay.
I've been singing the song a bit tonight, but I think that it's important to recognize that there's levels of coarseness in breaking a precept. So it's really easy to break a precept at a fine level and a little harder to break it at a coarse level. And I think that the difference in contrition and atonement might be different, you know, behavior after the fact when you're trying to repair what damage has been done, changes.
Uh-huh.
Being bored, absolutely, you could look at it. But I think if we start to parse it so fine all the time, it would be daunting, and you just kind of throw up your hands.
Okay.
But I'm not saying that that's not true, or that you shouldn't, that a person, when they have the ability to look at that level.
Uh-huh.
But certainly, they've got vertical or horizontal rather than it would have been a whole different level of breaking that precept.
Okay, so there are gradations of breaking a precept.
Isn't that kind of the difference between being angry and indulging in anger? Mm-hmm. So you can have the feeling, this kind of just happened, but it's what you do then with it. So the boredom might be, it comes up, but then what do you do with it?
Then is the silly kiss breaking the precept? Yeah. In that, using that with anger and not indulging it?
Yeah.
Is that breaking the precept because you didn't indulge that any further?
Oh, you've been indulging this for a week.
Okay.
Right. Well, I like what you said, Amber, because you can break this precept and be celibate.
Yep.
And you can keep this precept and be promiscuous. Is this this precept? There is a granular level where you can just kind of go to town and get yourself in trouble, but at the more subtle level, this precept is not just about sexual behavior. It's about the sexual being, which is the alive body. So Chisha talking about body shaming, body hatred, self-destructive behaviors, withholding sex from an intimate partner when that's part of the contract. Those are all ways that you can break this without any sexual activity at all. This is where volition really starts to get significant here.
Intent.
What?
Volition and intent.
Intent. Yeah. And that, you know, this body, speech, and mind, we kind of hate the idea that our thoughts are also involved here, but they are. So is a sexual fantasy about a stranger while you're involved in a sexual relationship, is that breaking the precept? It's a good question.
How many of you think that would be? If you're in a committed relationship, you see somebody super hot on the street and you have this outrageous mental-only fantasy, is that breaking the precept or not? Yes?
Yeah.
To be
harder.
Yes?
Yeah.
If you see a sailor, then roleplay
later. Okay, well, number.
I'd like to conduct a mind control experiment right now. Dog. How many of you thought, like, dog, what did the image of that word bring up to you? Did you have a choice in thinking about that?
Yeah. That's why I'm like this, because we just have these thoughts.
Yeah.
But honest question is, if you basically then create, indulge, and feed a fantasy, that's more than you feel angry, you haven't broken a precept, but you indulge it with a fantasy of angry behavior.
That's creating the veneer of
That's what I was going to mention, is that we feel all kinds of things initially, but it's about what we do with those feelings, I think, is more important. You know, because potentially you could have those feelings and then be open with your partner about it. They might share the feelings with you. You know? Like, it depends.
Yes. Well, and this goes back to the comment I read earlier of Kyogen's about not getting attached to your equanimity, because all kinds of stuff is going to come up. Mm-hmm. And then the point is then what happens next? Mm-hmm.
Seems like there's a point where you actually can become aware of what's happening, because there, from my experience, some things just are such a deep habit pattern that it's happening. I don't even really catch it, but through this process of investigating this, I'm learning how to catch it more. So I think, to me, it's like when I actually am aware of what's happening, then if I indulge, I think of that as like kind of moving into the side of breaking a precept. But otherwise, it's kind of my own ignorance, in a sense, I guess, that I'm up against.
Is that the game?
Yes. We didn't discuss it in our group, but I just thought of this while we were all talking, and I'm really new to this. And you take the word bored, and the basic concept of Buddhist teachings is to, contentment. And if you confuse contentment with boredom, I can see that. And going out to, we've got the marketing system and the world and Christianity where you're going to this higher level of existence where everything's perfect and wonderful, and you get used to that, and just going for a state of contentment, that's completely changing your mindset.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's what you say is true, but be careful also to not get too invested in contentment, because the purpose of practice is not to somehow foster a state where things don't bother you anymore. It's to foster a state where you can accept them wholeheartedly and work with them in a way that's helpful versus reacting adversely or reacting in this kind of way, looking for a distraction. And so even things that are unpleasant or challenging that come up, the point of Zen practice is not to stifle those or tamp those down. It's to say, here it is in all its nasty glory or messiness or whatever, and to work with it in a way that's helpful versus conditioned by your karma. And so it's not, believe me, it's not as you progress in your practice that it's all this contentment.
Darn!
I know. It's hard to disappoint
early, not even always pleasant.
But I was partly hearing Dave saying that some of it's about how you conceive of a relationship and what a relationship is supposed to give you. And what we might call boredom on one hand, on the other hand, is domestic bliss and everyday companionship. And there are, some of us are just driven to have newness and shiny new objects in our life. And that, so some of these precepts are harder for people driven for shiny new objects than others. And, to have sensation brought up. So, I don't know if that was part of what you were saying. It's also a way to just settle into that state of sameness.
Like the expression, boringly good.
Yeah.
And so, is there such a thing as kind of breaking a precept?
Has to do with how you were leaping that day.
Caught your foot on the.
No, I think this is a really interesting question. I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on it. Yeah.
These aren't my thoughts. These are
Kyogen's. Okay.
Nice to
what do you got?
Fantastic. So, in the precept study guide, he's chumming about the first precept of killing, and someone asks, why would someone get all bent out of shape when you chop a worm in half, when you're gardening? And Kyogen says, there comes a time when the meaning of the precepts is very powerful. It has to do with increasing your powers of empathy. As you drop your defenses to your own suffering and the suffering around you, your ability to really understand the suffering, something like a worm, increases. But fussing about every microbe, you'll end up paralyzed. So that was kind of speaking of the granularity, I guess the kind of breaking, half-breaking a precept is perhaps if it's getting you towards empathy, then that's the point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I find that I almost every day break none of the precepts and break every one of them. Yep. It just depends on where I'm gonna, how high I'm leaping. It was what I like what you said so much. But today I didn't break any gross precepts. Okay. From all the other ones.
So if there's kind of a scale then.
Yeah.
Okay. I think it was said that Priest of Practice is learning how to fail, but gently.
Okay. Madeline, what did you say?
I think for me in the early years, I thought about this question and the breaking of the precepts, but at some point, my perspective on the precepts changed completely, and for me, they are more the medicine to relieve my suffering. Mm-hmm. I don't go to them, I no longer look at them as, am I doing it right? Mm-hmm. But I go to them as a refuge to live right, to live well. And it completely flipped for me. It's really not about ethics anymore.
What's it about?
It's about relieving my suffering. I go to them for, oh, that's how it is. Uh-huh. You know, for those little moments of, oh, I remember.
Right.
Yeah.
So that struck me into that absolute view in which you naturally keep the precepts because your nature wants to and is it's the nature of your nature to keep these precepts.
I'm drawn to that. That's why I'm a member of the Cloud Appreciation Society.
We'll talk about this later.
There's a brilliancy of
think we have a subgroup.
Sorry, no, thank you, that's helpful. Mm-hmm. Ever.
I just want to that you find comforting in, and I was wondering if it sounds like it gives you clarity or it gives you some refuge because it's sort of a reminder of the Buddha nature, so like who you are, maybe? Is that kind of what you mean?
I didn't hear the first part of your question.
Sorry, I mumbled. I'm wondering, I want to understand what you said better. You said that you kind of go to the precepts as I heard almost themes of like refuge there, that it gives you peace, or would you say it's because it's like a reminder of true nature or the true Buddha nature, and that's comforting in a way? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think kind of what she was saying. I'm drawn to, it reminds me of who I really am. Mm-hmm. But it's also very practical, like, you know, I got really internally pissed off at somebody at work today. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, without any effort, because I've read this so many times, it's like, oh, I'm praising myself and blaming other. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's what I'm doing. So it wasn't like I was trying to say, did I keep the precept? It came up to show me what I was doing. It's like, oh, that's what you're doing, okay. And then it just disappeared like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's when it got laid, when my behavior found its place in the precepts. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't thought about them as anything other than rules yet, so that's why I was interested.
I didn't try to make it that way. It just happened over time.
When I hear you say that, it reminds me of last week, because a person with a contrite heart is quite open to the precepts, and they come easy.
Yes.
And when I brought up sitting up straight and was asked, is there any more you want to say about that? And I said, no. So I had to figure, well, what else do you say about that? You sit up and wholeheartedly ask for contrition. Mm-hmm. And so for you, it's already kind of done. You have a contrite heart.
Well, yeah, I grew up in my household when I was a kid. There was this phrase that don't let the sun go down on your hurt. And so as a little kid, I would rush to my brother, my sister, my parents as the sun was going down, oh, quick, before the sun, I've got to go apologize. Or not necessarily apologize, but like say something. You know.
Make
or what, I don't know what my 6-year-old mind was thinking, but it's just sort of came up, I think.
That's who you are.
It's a very endearing image, but
I can see
you doing it.
Okay, one other question. I'm dying to know what you thought. Since you didn't have sex with Jesse, did you tell Alex what's been going on? And I'd like to hear some of the folks I haven't heard less from. Michelle, what about you?
Oh, I wasn't missing my phone.
Yeah. What did your group say about the need to fess up to the partner here?
We had differing views.
Okay.
Some people definitely wouldn't. Some of us would. So,
mm-hmm.
personally, I thought, we're kind of, I think there was a, depending on your relationship, your committed relationship that you're in, I think for me, I would probably tell the person, tell my partner, because it's a symptom of something going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need to, even though that might hurt your partner, and that's, I guess that's the chance to take, but mm-hmm. it could also lead to a stronger relationship later, and maybe help build something better that, you know, so that you're not bored in your relationship. I mean, you have, and it's back to the boredom. I mean, it's it needs to be addressed.
Yep. And what were some of the competing or different opinions in the group?
Okay. I stayed with Al-Anon for like several years, and one of the like principles in Al-Anon is to make amends unless to do so would cause more harm.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where like the edginess on that kind of comes up.
Uh-huh.
Is, you know, like, am I really just owning this to absolve myself and unburden my partner?
Mm-hmm.
Am I creating suffering for them so I can leave my own suffering? So
right.
That was just like the dialectic. Okay. Obviously, like, there's other things that are interest for, you know,
right.
getting to the wine bar.
Sure. That came up in our group too.
Yeah, we thought possible you could kill your relationship if you went through and, you know, told your partner.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, maybe in terms of just a precept, if everything worked out and you had a happy ending, that would be the perfect solution to not violate the precept.
Right. Okay.
Except.
Yeah, go ahead, Gabriel.
Do you really think this other person doesn't know?
I said, they probably find the text message.
And B, how is it for me if I'm keeping a secret?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things, you know, my feeling about it is there's no cut and dry answer here, but but all those things need to be taken into consideration.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it sounds to me like there's enough going on that for the partner to not know that something's going on would be... not very likely.
Okay. There's a lot of busy people.
Well, this is...
They don't know what's going on. Yeah, I think it depends on who the person is.
That's why I say it.
Maybe ask them. You want to know? I'll tell you.
You
want to
know?
You don't want to
know.
Okay.
We are never getting on.
Our discussion
sounded, most of the time, it sounded very much like what Will said, that if you were to tell someone, your partner, it could shatter them, it could, you know, it could kill a lot, not just a relationship, it could be very damaging, it really... just would depend on the situation and depend on the other person involved.
Okay. Tegan, do you want to report from your group?
Just, I was in Gemma's group. And, we were very relativistic, but this is why wisdom and compassion are always put together. It might seem wise to just be completely transparent in your relationship, but it's not always the compassion to do. Always just going to be a little harder than we'd like it to be.
Okay. I know there are a few more comments. I want to pause here, though, so I can set us up for next week's discussion. So the handout that I gave you last week about, it was the excerpt from Precepts' Path from Kyogen. There are a couple of sections in there that I'm going to start with next time. I wanted to have this discussion before we jumped into that. Kyogen talks a little bit about relativity in that excerpt. So I'd like you to take a look at that for next week and the way you understand him to mean relativity. Ethical relativism can be a sort of hot button for a lot of people, so I want to clarify what he means by that. And it relates also to this idea of, are the precepts inflexible? Are there gradations of violations of the precepts? Are wisdom and compassion trump cards over the precepts, that kind of stuff. So please take a look at that section of last week's handout. I have more if you didn't get one. And I'd also like to look at next week some of the commentaries. So after the precepts, there are these beautiful kind of poetic commentaries. And we're going to talk more about where those come from and ways to work with them next week. So maybe as your assignment, as you're reading the precepts this week, maybe focus a little bit more on those commentaries and how you understand them. And we'll start with that next time. All right, thank you for a great discussion, guys. Great conversation.